This is the Lean Construction Blogs podcast, a podcast dedicated to stories, case studies, and lessons learned of applying lean construction from around the world. Join Dick Beyer as he interviews industry leaders, lean construction practitioners, and subject matter experts to help you improve the built environment in general and your design and construction projects in particular. Advance your lean journey and bring your continuous improvement efforts to the next level. Let's get started.
Good day, everybody, from wherever you are. I'm Dick Beyer, and this is the podcast from leanconstructionblog.com. Today, I am on the road in Southern California, headed for the golf course after this. But first, I wanted to check in with my friend and technical expert on all things having to do with the world, Jerry McCabe. Jerry's the head of all Canadian operations for Turner & Townsend, and when we hit these supply chain issues and COVID came, he's the first guy that I wanted to talk to say, yikes, Jerry, what do we do about this? So good morning, Jerry. How are you?
Morning, Dick. I'm very well. How are you doing?
I am spectacular, as you can imagine. Thank goodness I'm here in Southern California. This is my first actual vacation in, I don't know, like 30 years.
It's not good.
I've had time when I wasn't billing, but you know, when you own your own company, you don't really like go on vacation. So This has been great for me. I'm training all over the country, all over the states, and it's going to be fun. So welcome. Thanks for doing this.
Not at all. Anytime.
So you're not originally from Canada, like lots of Canadians.
That's right. No, I was born and bred in Belfast in Ireland.
Okay, so it's interesting because we always refer to that as Northern Ireland. Do you just refer to it as Ireland?
I refer to Belfast as Ireland, yeah. Belfast is it's part of Ireland. It's also part of Britain, which gets complicated, but I'm Irish.
And you were and you grew up during the Troubles, as they said, right?
I did, yeah, I did. I was born... the trouble started in 1969. I was about six or seven at the time. So I lived through that, which was, difficult time. It's unfortunate that happened. But things are much better now. I mean, all my family still, most of my family are still in Belfast, and I got to see them just recently there a few weeks ago when I was back for our AGM in London. I popped over to Belfast.
Oh, fantastic.
For a couple of days. And, Belfast is a completely different, Northern Ireland is a completely different, Belfast, different city now. It's completely changed from when I was there. It's opened up. It's really great, actually. It's bubbling. About the city's alive. It's developed. There's lots of activity. So
that's fantastic. So you were telling me a story one time that your car got stolen and the police were fortunate enough to find it. But the story starts from there.
Yeah. I was in my still at university, actually, I think. And I had a car. I was using a car. I was on my year out in Belfast, and I parked the car in the city of Belfast. And at that time, there were a lot of cars getting stolen for the young guys were taking cars for joyrides, basically. But there are also cars that were being stolen to be used for, different types of activities, like planting bombs in them and things like that. So anyway, my car got stolen at lunchtime in the city, and I went around to the police station, and they said, so I was waiting for the police to figure out where the car was, and they finally found it in the middle of a football pitch of a school in what is West Belfast. So they put me into the back of, and this was the police, but it was the police and the army. They had a sort of an armored vehicle. We called them Saracens. Yeah. So we're in the back of a Saracen with a number of young British soldiers. And we went up to the school and the car was at the far end of the football field on fire. They said, we were sort of out of the vehicle. We were standing behind the school wall. And they asked me if that was my car. And I said, well, I don't know if that's my car. It's hard to see. It's it's at the other end of the football field and it's on fire. So I said, okay, well, we have to go over and you have to identify the car. And I said, okay. But then that meant they were walking out into the middle of a football field. So they were, you know, open. And of course, at that time, you know, this was used as an opportunity to maybe expose some of the British Army, or sort of
lure them into a situation.
Yeah. So they weren't going over to the car to identify it. So they sent me. So I had to walk across the football pitch, identify the car, walk back and say, yeah, that's my car. And then we all got back into the armored vehicle and went back to the police station.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. You know, it reminds me of the time I had a little oil company in Los Angeles. And somebody had left a wrong valve open. And we had these converters that were micro generators, basically, that were running on wellhead gas. But because they mixed with the oil, they caught on fire. The fire department showed up right away. But they said, one of you guys needs to go back there and turn off the gas. And I said, what? Isn't that your job? They said, no, it's way too dangerous. I'm going, yeah. I said, one of my guys back there. Yeah. Anyway, somebody volunteered, but well, it must have been that's quite a background. How did you get to Canada?
Well, my sister lived here, and when I graduated from university, 1985, there was not much for me in Belfast. It was a pretty difficult time, and of course, I also wanted to do a bit of traveling. So I left and traveled around for about a year, and then I came to Toronto, where my sister was living, and I met who is now my wife at the time. I went back to Belfast, and I told my mom I was moving to Canada. I was going to give it a couple of years, so I came over. At that time, you know, my wife wasn't my wife, and she didn't know that I was pursuing her at the time, but.
It was a self pursuit. It was the very best kind of pursuit.
It was a stalking. Yeah. So anyway.
That's illegal. Stealth is better.
It's stealth. That's right. Yeah. So I stealthily came to Canada and and then I got an opportunity to work with Buster Vermeulen, who had been here for quite a while. He basically established himself, and Frank Hellier established quantity surveying in Canada in the 50s. And when I came here, I was lucky enough to get a job with Frank and with Buster. I started working with Buster and I worked with him for a few years. And then I ended up actually joining Hellier at the time, the early 90s. And I worked with Niall and Colin Kelleher and Mike Barker and guys like that. And that's where I met Greg Curran. And then Greg and I left in 2000 and with Manoj Ravindran, and we started our own company, which was called CM2R in 2000. And then we grew that in Toronto for a few years until I met Vince Clancy. Actually met Vince in a bar in Toronto.
Of course, yeah. I mean, where else would you meet a Vince Clancy?
Yeah, Vince and I chatted.
The Irish Day Parade, St. Paddy's Day Parade, or in a bar, right?
It was actually, I met him in the Irish Embassy in Toronto.
There you go.
Yeah, so anyway, we were chatting, and at that time, P3 public-private partnerships were becoming fairly popular in Canada. And it was something we were looking to get in more involved in. Vince said, and I remembered Vince had talked about the experiences they had and the extensive experience in public private partnerships in the UK. And this was, in the early 2000s. So an opportunity came up, and I called Vince and asked if he was interested to support us, because we didn't have any capability to do P3s. And these were for the Alberta Schools projects. This opportunity came up. So Vince very graciously agreed, and he introduced me to Dominic Ledson, who ran their P3 team in the UK, and we pursued that opportunity. And We weren't successful in that, but we then pursued another, which we were successful on, and that then evolved into, over the course of the next few years, we were working with Dominic and Turner Townsend on probably a dozen different P3 projects, which then led into Vince, Tom Harrison, who was the CFO, came over and asked us if we'd be interested in joining Turner Townsend, and we thought, it was myself and Greg and Manoj and Simon and Mark Jones, thought that you know, that would be could be a good idea. It was a difficult decision, but yeah. Finally a decision that I've never regretted.
So you sold the company to Turner Townsend, is
it? We started. It was we at the time we sold about 60%, and then over the years Turner Townsend there was a partnership creation of a partnership with Turner Townsend, which went. We then divested the rest of our business and joined the partnership, and that was about 7 or 8 years ago.
Yeah, well, I'm glad that worked out. I recently had that same quandary when I was approached to sell the Realignment Group of Canada to Colliers Project Leaders, and after a bit of a rocky start, it's actually turned out to be quite a good partnership.
It's difficult. You know, you've built a business and you know that you're sort of changing your involvement and your lack your level of control. And that was the biggest, really. That was the biggest. There was no problem. I mean, culturally, we were aligned and we knew Turner Townsend's successful business. So from a business perspective, it was making sense. It was the realizing that you were moving along, but I've never regretted it. It's been, I mean, we've now changed the business in Canada. It's completely transformed.
Well, what was difficult for me was that I hadn't worked for anybody for 30 years and suddenly there's an HR department. I mean, you can imagine what an HR department and I would, you know,
yeah.
No, when I run into the HR department, man, it's like, here comes a small hurricane. But like I say, it's worked out in it. I thought of Colliers as like my angel investor, and it's really allowed me to expand the team and do all the kinds of things I'd like to do.
Yeah.
So it's been a good partnership.
Yeah. And of course, we started this coming into Canada. You know, I've been now in Canada since 1986, and I'm a Canadian citizen now. And, you know, it's as far as I'm concerned, it's the best country in the world.
Oh yeah,
it's given me every opportunity I needed, and it's a very, very easy country to live in. And I'm sitting here looking out at what is, you know, I'm on a lake up in northern Ontario right now. It's beautiful.
It really is a lovely place. I mean, I agree. I mean, even though I'm still an American, I'm a permanent resident, and I do believe that it solved so many of the issues around basic lifestyle, basic safety net, basic social contract. And it really is a spectacular place to live. And people talk about the cold and I talk about buying a coat. And so
that's right. There's no such thing as bad weather. You know, it's just bad.
Yeah. And really Ottawa is, if you can survive Ottawa, you can survive both basically any place in Canada. So,
yep.
And it's just one of the fine cities. I mean, I would recommend everybody who listens to the podcast move to Ottawa. It's a spectacular urban setting that's very livable and scalable, and it's great.
And busy. Anyway. And extremely busy.
Yes, a lot of things going on.
You've
packed like 126,000 employees into Ottawa, I think.
Almost. Yeah, we're getting there. And but as I say, Ottawa is a very stable market, and it's a relatively small market for the amount of work that's going on there in terms of capital programs. There are some very large programs drawing on a relatively small pool of resources.
And, yeah.
There are great opportunities for people who move to Ottawa. There are fantastic projects going on, really important projects going on in Ottawa for people.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, we met on the center block, and the center block is still chugging along. It's unfortunate that 6.5 years into the mission, we're still looking for that agreed upon schematic design. But I think we're getting there. So
good. Yep.
good people with good heart, and they're trying to do the right thing. So they're taking their time to make sure they get it right, because you wouldn't want to get that one wrong.
No.
So you became a chartered quantity surveyor. And so people all over the world listen to this podcast, which is weird to me, but we've had like 12,000 downloads or something, and from 36 countries. And certainly in the States, people don't understand the difference between like a chief estimator and a quantity surveyor. And I think there are some differences from my perspective. I think that the quantity surveyors have certain agreed upon standards for things like estimates and the rest of that. And your former colleague, Chris Cadell, he sat on the board of the worldwide cost estimating people, whatever that association is called.
AACE.
So are there any significant differences between quantity surveying and kind of estimating worldwide, or there's a difference in a practice in Canada?
Well, yeah, I mean, quantity surveying is a profession. I mean, it's an established profession, but it's really just it's like becoming an accountant, but then accountants can do all sorts of things. There's a certain level of capability and that you're trained to do it. But quantity surveying in its purest form is not something that is used in its more traditional sense. You know, methods of procurement and different types of management of capital programs has evolved since the production of bills of quantities. I'm sure there are still projects around the world where bills of quantities are used, but that's just the means to an end. And I think the training we get, the training that I got, and I know that those programs have evolved as well from what the sort of skills that we were taught in terms of measurement of quantities. But really, part of that full program taught us about the life cycle of a project, the end to end of the development process, how you should set up programs for success at the outset, and how you then set up the controls and then manage the program and the controls through the delivery of the full life cycle of the project. And it's more about those skills, how to set up the program, how to set up the budget, how to set up the schedule, how to manage the program through against those controls, which is important. And that's what's evolved now. And so as a quantity surveyor, I haven't picked up a scale rule in 25 years, but understanding, the basics of how to manage and control projects, how to manage and control risk through projects, establishing baselines, managing against baselines. I mean, those are all pretty fundamentals of what quantity surveyor can do.
So I'm a member of the Construction Historical Society, which is located in the UK. And so every year they have a conference at Cambridge, which I think is kind of cool. But there was an article published by one of their board members about rebuilding churches in England in the early 1700s as a result of the Great Fire in London. And Christopher Wren and all of these guys running these programs. And this is from which people kind of think about the master builder. But it turned out that the quantity surveyor was the guy that actually ran those projects, because he was basically the clerk of the works. And he was also the guy that was trying to do early project management with labor strikes because people weren't being paid, bad mortar in the cement, trying to find cheaper wood for the beams from Sweden instead of old forest oak. And I'm going, wow, this sounds like the center block.
Very much. I think there is, like what we do today. I think there's a reference in one of Shakespeare's plays to quantity surveyors.
it's an ancient profession. Well, there's certainly a reference in his plays about lawyers. So
we don't have to go there. Yeah, not lawyers. No, I know. So,
So one of the things I'm interested in, and this is something that you guys helped us with at CenterBlock is that when we're doing one of these lean projects and we're doing something in the nature of like integrated project delivery, and we are trying to get our arms around a price for a project that hasn't been designed yet. I think that's a real trick, given that, you know, there are no plans for takeoffs and there are no things like that. So how do you approach integrated project delivery or Alliancing or some of those collaborative contracts where we're trying to figure out what we're going to build, how we're going to build it, and at the same time, what that's going to cost? Because it's important for us that cost is an input to design as opposed to an output from design, which is how it's traditionally been.
Yeah. I mean, I think data, we've got, you know, lots of data, using data from real data from other projects that are relevant. And there's a certain amount of science involved in applying data to develop, you know, reasonable budgets for projects that aren't yet designed. And there's a certain amount of art involved in it as well. It's not just simple application of a number against an area to say, well, it's X dollars per square foot, and you've got 100,000 square foot, and here's the number. The best, the most accurate budgets that we've ever developed have used the data that we've got, analyzed that data, modified that data to suit what the project is and what the program is for the project. But more importantly, developing that budget baseline alongside all of the other contributors to the project. So it's impossible to develop, regardless of how good your data is, it's impossible to develop a robust, accurate, reasonable budget in isolation. It has to be done in conjunction with the rest of the team, from the owner's team, from the design team, and there a recognition that this is an estimate, and it's only as good as the level of involvement that there has been, the level of collaboration has been with everybody involved, and everyone should all those who are involved need to completely understand the basis of that estimate and the assumptions, because there will be a large number of assumptions that go into developing a baseline when there's no design. Everyone should be aware of what those assumptions are, and then you can develop a risk profile around the budget to be clear about, you know, how resilient that estimate, that baseline should be. Because things will change. Things always change.
Yeah. And so you're preaching to the choir when we talk about assumptions, because owners tend to think of budgets as, you know, cast in stone. These are the 15, 10 commandments of the project that we're going to move forward with. And I think my experience as a lawyer, as a trial lawyer, dissecting construction problems that, you know, big projects that fell apart, was that we were making an awful lot of assumptions about stuff that we could have known more about. So if we'd had the trades on board earlier, we'd had the contractor on board earlier, we had all of the people that were important to gather input from, you know, on early, which is one of the reasons I like the IPD process, and I like Design Assist that we've been using at CenterBlock, because it just gives you, you're able to narrow some of those assumptions. And if risk is just what we don't know and something we have to make an assumption about, the fewer assumptions we make, the less risk we have.
Agreed. And so there are going to be assumptions, and but there's also, you know, there's a certain amount of, what's important is, I think, you know, making sure the budget is honest. You know, there's a number in every project. There's going to be a number of different agendas, and which can sort of work to influence the budget or the baseline, and that always goes wrong.
Right.
It will always go wrong if you're trying to do anything other than just establish what should be a robust budget for a baseline or a robust budget. robust estimate. If there's anything else going on other than that, then the baseline is going to be wrong.
Yeah. And so I think of those baseline budgets as really a cost model, because that then reflects how robust it is, how it changes. We're constantly modeling not only the building in 3D, but we're constantly modeling what those costs should be, because we get more and better information as we start to develop things. And what I have always wanted is I always wanted the Turner and Townsend guys, the Bens and the Moes in Ottawa to be sitting in the room with HOK and WSP and Centris and giving them, you know, immediate feedback on what, you know, what the temporary roof is going to cost, or what, yep, what different strategies would cost. Because I think that's a really important part of how a team develops a strategy for moving forward on a project.
Yeah, agreed. I mean, real-time input, whether it's cost or schedule or risk, having real-time input into that to help decision-making is, that's leveraging the real value of what we do.
I think, you know, when you mentioned data, I think you guys did. So not only the Buster Vermeulens of the world, the A.W. Hookers, the Turner and Townsends, the folks that play in that space, seem to manage data so much better than general contractors, for instance. Like, I've had conversations with a lot of general contractors who say that, you know, I would have assumed that after you build a project, you would go back and you'd look at your early estimates and you would see how closely they aligned with what you actually built. And I have yet to find anybody that does that on a regular basis, because they say, well, we just don't have the time. We're moving on to the next project. Yeah. So how do you launder your data to make sure that it's and launder in the good sense? Yeah, yeah. How do you scrub it so that you know that you're getting closer? And I'm assuming you guys do that.
We do. I mean, we've invested heavily in the last number of years with an initiative that we call The Hive, which is really taking data and collecting it and scrubbing it, as you say, and leveling it and making sure that it's real and it's, you know, it's as accurate as it can be, and then we can apply it and we can develop out of that hive all sorts of benchmarks, all sorts of reference points. From the macro level of, you know, from a cost per square foot basis, but all the way down to benchmarking against input costs, the cost of labor, the cost of different types of materials. So that is what we do. And I say, you're, I think you're right. Some contractors are more sophisticated than others, of course, but for the most part, that's not what contractors are out building buildings. They're not necessarily
right,
developing and analyzing data. I'm pretty sure there are some, you know, I know there are some of the more sophisticated contractors have got lots of data that they can use and they do use. But this initiative that we've developed, and as I say, we've invested significantly in the last number of years, and we're now rolling out apps to apply for benchmarking and for different types of tools to help us
develop. Well, that's fantastic. That is something that's much needed. I had Mark Siegi on the podcast, and he is on the BIM Canada team. And his thing is about AI, but it's also about managing the cosmology of data. I mean, just the immense amount of data that's available out there can give you so much noise. You know, how do you actually, you know, scale that, filter it, bring it to bear so that it can actually make predictions that will, you know, help you, whether it's parametric modeling or it's, you know, the rhinos or the grasshoppers of the world where you stuff all these things into a job.
Yeah.
So it's really heartening to hear that you guys are moving in that direction. I think that's really good for the industry.
And one of the good things, and we've talked earlier about quantity surveying and those professions, whether it's the RACS or AACE, I mean, what they have done is provided us with the basis to harvest data, because they've developed and, you know, they work historically to develop methods of measurement, how you should develop budgets and measure buildings and present buildings from a cost perspective in a consistent way. And most important thing about collecting data is to be able to collect it consistently. And then be able to apply the parametric modeling and scrubbing the data effectively. But though the basis, the methods of measurement that the RICS and the Canadian Institute of Quantitative Surveyors and others have provided for us means that there's a generally accepted way of measuring and presenting cost in construction, which provides us with the basis and the sort of the framework to be able to collect the data consistently.
So one of the issues, so as you're collecting the data and you're looking at different ways of creating a building and pricing it, we always end up creating contingency. And in my world, you just want to make that contingency transparent. So when we as a team on an IPD project or someplace else get to a final budget, whether it's progressive design build or we're getting to a GMP or we're getting to the validation at the end of IPD so that we are committing to a number, one of the things we try to do is we try to take every risk we have and put a price to it, and we create contingency based on a risk-priced matrix. And it's even if it's, you know, it's the risk of what we don't know, we still try to put a number in there so that we're at least applying some logic to it so we can identify buffer and float even in schedules as risk that we can mitigate. Because if it's hidden, you can't mitigate it. So how do you, in this new world of the work that you guys have been doing, what's your approach to contingency and how many different contingencies there are and all the rest of that stuff?
Yeah. Well, I think you put your finger on it. It's collaboration. It's transparency. I mean, we talked earlier about assumptions and that the whole team from the owner all the way through the design team need to understand what assumptions there are contained within the development of any estimate to make sure that. And then contingencies are part of that. So contingencies are really, as you say, putting a number against the things that we don't know or the things that we can't really define fully within an estimate. And all of the parties to the program should be aware of what those assumptions are and what the contingencies are, how they've been developed and how they should be used. Typically, we would have contingencies for design, so to provide us with the opportunity to draw upon whenever the design evolves, and the designs will always evolve. There will always be design development, so there's a design contingency. There's a what we call an escalation contingency, because we know over the course of time, particularly over programs that are over a number of years, like the Center Block program, that'll be 10, 15 years from start to finish. When we're producing estimates for projects that won't be built for another 5 or 6 or 10 years, construction costs will increase. And so you need to include contingency to deal with increases in construction costs due to inflation or construction cost escalation. Another contingency that we typically identify is we call post-contract contingency or construction contingency, is to deal with things that will happen after design is completed and after construction, after the tenders have been set and bids have been awarded, contracts have been put in place. Contractor goes on site and inevitably there'll be things that will be discovered on site that were never considered. When you're digging a hole in front of Center Block, you're going to find things that no one thought were there.
Yeah.
They will typically add cost. They'll be impacting schedule. So you need a contingency to deal with those unknowns that happen through after contract and also to deal with things that will change as a result of owner-directed changes. So those are three contingencies that are required. And then, there's a, with all of that, you talked about risk. And so there's risks that are inherent in the design and in the construction. And then there's other risks that are external to the program itself. And there are certain things that you will have control over, and there's things that you won't. And I think there's also contingencies that should be identified for all of that sort of risk contingency.
So how has COVID changed the way that you guys look at that last risk? It's certainly a black swan event. It was something that would never have been at neither the COVID itself nor the reaction of governments worldwide closing down markets. And I mean, I remember March 13th, 2020 being in Center Block and going home and saying, we're going to be closed for 2 weeks. And voila. How has it impacted what you guys do?
Well, it. I don't think an event like that can be accounted for. You know, if we were to try to assess risk associated with those sorts of black swan events that you've, like COVID, nothing would ever get built. You know, the cost of it would be, you know, the identifying the cost of that risk would be so large that, you know, you would just, you, no one would be doing anything. So I don't think you can assess the risk associated with something like that.
So the other side of that is forecasting the impact of things like that down the future. And you guys are in the forecast business, which I think is what makes your data so valuable, is that you're able to not only have historical data that is true and scrubbed and pretty robust, but you also look ahead to economic consequences of things. And so how are you, the things that I think everybody's been afraid of coming out of this are supply chain issues, because the supply chain wasn't there, you know, and it wasn't just, you used to be able to order drywall on Friday and get it on Monday. Yep. Now you order drywall and it's, well, if the truck comes in from Winnipeg and if the boat comes in from China and if the train doesn't run over anybody, you know, we may have some on Tuesday. Right. So how can you help us out here in the industry understand what those risks are and how best to try to mitigate them?
So, I mean, in terms of COVID and the impact it's had on the supply chain, that still exists. We're still seeing the impact of that. It hasn't sort of resolved itself yet, but it will. You know, I mean, eventually the supply chain will resolve and materials will be delivered again on time. Or as they were before COVID. So that's going to resolve itself. You know, how long will that take? Who knows? I mean, some materials have already resolved themselves and some haven't. I mean, that's just going to take time. Right. I'm more concerned about, as far as capital projects are concerned, particularly, all around the world, really, but in most developed countries and certainly in Canada. One of the biggest problems or challenges we have as an industry is the supply of skilled labor. Mm. And skilled labor is not as easy to resolve. It's not from a supply chain perspective, that's not something that can just get resolved quickly by increasing production in a factory.
Right.
You know, and you know, we know right now that the average age of your typical skilled worker, or in Canada and again in most developed countries, is getting older, and we're not yet at a point where we're increasing the supply of that through our education processes, our universities and colleges. And labor makes up more than half of the cost of any project.
Right.
And if you don't have available skilled labor, then the cost of that is going to go up. It's simple supply and demand. And we are seeing, all across this country anyway. Certainly, and we talked about how busy Ottawa is. We know that right now, pre-COVID and certainly coming after COVID, construction cost escalation in Ottawa is significantly higher than it ever was and typically higher than anywhere else across the country. And that's right. Driven not just by, obviously, COVID, but it's driven also by the availability of contractors and construction companies and major subtrades to deliver the volume of work that's in on it.
Right.
And it's true across the country. It's the same in Toronto, it's the same in Vancouver, Montreal. So whenever construction volume gets to a point where the availability of labor and the availability of the contractors capable of delivering projects of scale, as soon as one overtakes the other, we're going to see, and we'll continue to see, increases in costs and challenges around delivery because of resources, of labor resources.
So we just went through our tricycle in Ontario of the union negotiations, where we had the operators on strike for a bit, and we had some other folks on strike. And when they came back and they settled those union things, I think they agreed on something like 12% over 3 years or some you know, fairly significant, what you wouldn't normally expect CPI to be doing. Does that reflect, how do you use that information as you reflect on looking at the future and that labor supply chain? Because I agree with you. I mean, when we look at doing the last planner system and we're trying to free up resources, you know, 20% of the resources, we can look at a direct correlation in 10% less cost. If you use 20% fewer folks on the project and you're paying time and materials, you know, you can save some money.
Yeah,
but
sure.
How do those labor negotiations or those things benchmark fit into how you're looking at projecting labor costs going forward?
Well, they have a direct impact on the cost of construction in the future. We have to include within our escalation rates the impact of increased cost of labor, and those labor negotiations were just a point in time this year. I mean, they happen every other year, every 2 or 3 years once they come up again, and they're you know, not only, I mean, those are driven by the level of the amount of resource that's available, but also the volume of construction. I mean, it's in certain markets, particularly in these markets here in Canada, there's a significant volume of work. The market's busy,
right?
And so we would absolutely be factoring in the increase in cost of labor in our escalation rates. But I think the more importantly it's from an industry perspective, it's not going to be easy to solve the labor issue. We just can't all of a sudden produce, you know, electricians and plumbers and carpenters and then create contractors who are capable of delivering certain skills project. That's going to happen. That has to evolve over time. It's going to need a lot more effort. It's going to need government to assist. It's going to need, you know, society to think of construction trades for their sons and daughters as actually good careers. You know, we've all decided through a process of thinking that everyone needs to be and that going into the construction for some reason was not necessarily a good career. But I think, you know, going forward, some of the best careers we're going to be able to offer our kids, our sons and daughters, will be in construction.
And I think we're really lucky in Canada in that regard, because one of the things I've noticed in Canada is that, you know, if you make $150,000 a year, you get 5 weeks of vacation, you have a cottage and a boat, you know, Bob's your uncle, you're doing pretty well, you know, folks are feeling pretty good about that. And that indicates a broader middle class than what you're seeing in the States and perhaps in Europe as well, is that there does seem to be a larger middle class here. And with Canadian immigration, encouraging immigration, we may be able to have a leg up on electricians and skilled workers, you know, looking for a better opportunity in Canada. So I think there's some hope in Canada for sure.
Sure. But it also opens up the door to, so there's that, that's that sort of larger societal discussion. But then there's also just within the construction industry itself, it's not a very sophisticated industry. And we need to look at different ways of delivering, procuring and delivering capital programs that can respond to the resource related issues that we've got, and also more importantly, resolving the issues around cleaning up our, it's a very dirty industry, you know, in terms of contribution to global warming. The construction industry is one of the worst,
right up there, right?
And that is changing. And so there's a number of things that are going on right now within, and it, for me, that creates great opportunities,
right?
Not just for us and for you as organizations, but for individuals who want to get into the construction industry to help transform the industry from what is, I think, fairly inefficient, pretty dirty industry, but an industry that can contribute so much more to our society. You know, everything that we do in our society revolves around capital projects and buildings, whether it's government, whether it's entertainment, whether it's sport, you know, whatever it is, major contribution to society. And there's the opportunity to do it better, to do it more efficiently and more effectively, be able to provide really great careers for people. The opportunities are enormous.
Almost everything we do important happens inside a weatherproof box of some kind.
That's right.
And the built environment is so essential to what we're doing. And I think, you know, we're in the conversation, as you are, of rethinking the built environment, rethinking, you know, reuse of buildings, reuse of materials, design for manufacturers, obviously, robotics, yep. Those things are right at the top of the list.
Yep.
But in kind of a final wrap up, but there are trades I know during COVID, and I know a lot of trades well in Canada since I've been up here for the last 6.5 years working throughout the country, actually. There were some who basically hoarded materials during COVID. They got as much as they possibly could, and they put it in a warehouse someplace. And that leads to a strategy of mitigation that is expensive for projects. But should owners be thinking about a logistics strategy? Should they be thinking about, in addition to construction and hiring trades and designers, should they be thinking about warehouse mobilization where they can buy things, you know, as they need them, hold them and store them going forward? Are there mitigation strategies around this that are different than what we have been doing over the years?
Of course there are. Of course there are. And that's what I mean by evolving or developing our approach to procurement, our approach to engaging with the design community, the construction community, in how we deliver capital projects. I mean, you know, traditionally it's a owner gets a design team, they design it, they send it out to tender, contractor bids on it, usually the lowest price wins, and then they build it. And it's very disjointed, and it's as you probably know as a lawyer, it can also be very confrontational
and risky,
and very, very risky. And so, you know, and we've been doing that for hundreds, if not thousands, of years, and we keep doing it the same way, and that's not necessarily, and we still have a fairly inefficient and a fairly dirty industry. And you know, so I think there are definitely better ways of delivering, better ways of procuring, more efficient, more effective, more collaborative. We know what they are. It's not, and as you said, there's all sorts of ways of procuring material, you know, but it requires a level of collaboration where there's a shared risk, because typically we're trying to transfer risk, and that's, you know,
that doesn't work very well.
Doesn't work very well. No, I mean, I think there's a far better way of delivering, managing and controlling projects, of course, but using different methods of procurement, different methods of delivery.
I mean, we're seeing in the market, we're seeing a lot of interest for more collaborative delivery models, whether it's IPD or it's alliancing, progressive design build, progressive P3, CM at risk, where you spend some time developing a GMP, design build with, that progressive design build is a, you know, in concert with the owner until you get to that time when you feel confident about what it's going to cost and how long it's going to take. So I think that is, that's responding to some extent, and that's driven by the owners. It's not driven by the contractors, because in general, and I know lots of contractors, they're my friends, and I like them as people, but they're doing fine. They don't really have any desire to change the system. And, you know, when you and I are out there advocating for, look, this is really risky, they go, yeah, but it's working for us. So it really has to be driven by the owners, I think. And the owner community is starting to drive that conversation, I think.
We're seeing it. And we're seeing it not just in the private sector, but in the public sector also. And I like it when the public sector is driving innovation and, initiative. Because, you know, typically, traditionally, government, you know, they want this fixed price lump sum. But we've seen a significant move now towards different types of methods of procurement. They're becoming a lot more comfortable about it, which is good.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I'm successful in Canada because some of these collaborative models are taking off.
Yep.
And I think we're also changing the conversation from this kind of fairy tale of certainty to move to more reliability. If we just be more reliable, nobody's going to be certain, because the world is a risky place. But reliability is something that we can kind of build in within a, you know, benchmark 5 or 10% or whatever. We can build more reliable. We can build more reliably. Let's just say that.
Yep, agreed. Agreed. And the other part of that, and again, from a built environment perspective, we also need to be looking at ways of building better, building buildings that will last, that are adaptable, from a carbon production perspective, from a sustainability perspective. Building quality, quality trumps everything, really,
We're blessed with two sustainable resources in Canada, water and sustainable timber. And I think those two things are going to, really highlight what the built environment looks like in Canada over the next 30 years or so. So thanks for your leadership, my friend, in all of this. Keep up the good work at Turner & Townsend. I can't wait to see these apps that are coming out to help us get some more reliability around what those early numbers are, because I just, all of my projects deal with trying to get a budget before we know what we're building. And that's there's magic there. And you've been a leader in that. So thanks for that.
I appreciate that.
Thank you for tuning in to the Lean Construction Blogs podcast. If you've enjoyed this episode, please help us spread the word by sharing, subscribing, or leaving a review on your preferred podcast listening platform. Remember to join us next time as we continue to lower the barriers to applying lean construction and help take your lean journey to the next level. And don't forget to visit the Lean Construction blog to stay up to date on our latest podcast episodes, weekly blog posts, monthly webinars, and upcoming conferences. We hope to see you on the next episode.